Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Your future is important. Take time to plan for what can go right. Talk to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Tweet at Drive Time RTE.
As the cost of living continues to bite, many Christmas chefs are looking for the most cost-effective recipes to rustle up for their families this Christmas. But the best tips might just come from the cookbooks of Christmas past. Food and culinary historian Regina Sexton has been looking at recipes of Mrs. Beaton and her cronies, and she joins us now. You're very welcome, Regina, to the programme this evening. Food, firstly, has always been a huge part of celebrating Christmas, hasn't it? Way back when.
I suppose... Since we have records about Christmas that written down, sort of written texts, I suppose, isolate and talk about the importance of Christmas as one of the big festivals that mark any calendar year. But as you move through time, you come more into, I suppose, past the medieval period, you get more substance to the descriptions of food. And of course, they become more numerous as we come up to more contemporary times. But throughout all of those, central to making this calendar festival special was the role of food. So it plays a huge part in how we think about Christmas, how we function as humans in Christmas, and I suppose how we make kind of meaning around the whole festival for ourselves. It sort of circles around food largely. So food is really a central concern of all the celebrations, yeah. Both in the past and
the present, yeah, because we were speaking about Brussels sprouts earlier and people got maybe more exercise than I've seen people or our listeners in very many weeks about Brussels sprouts of all things. So people do feel very strongly about their Christmas meal and their Christmas feast. And what were the staples that we enjoyed in Christmas past then? Was meat always a central part of it?
It was, and you know, you can kind of distill it down, and you could see elements that make the Christmas. So a big concentration on meat and big birds of various different sorts, and then a strong presence of fat in the food as well. Fatty foods are just animal fat, and then the other big characteristics are an element of sweetness, which is indispensable to foods. And of course, the other thing is spice. So meat, fat, sugar and spice. Mm. These are the elements that are traditional and these are the elements that have come through us through time. And we still want to have a Christmas where those things are. We can taste those. They're present and they make our Christmas, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, and they're certainly all very present in our Christmas meals at the moment. A big bird, you say, was it not specifically turkey?
No, not at all. And you know, I suppose a lot of how we think about food is very much kind of is boxed in a present day context, and I think a lot of that has got to do with the whole commercialization of food throughout the 19th century and the various different sorts of propaganda, media, and advertising around that will give us this sort of immutable kind of Christmas fare package, if you like. But there are sort of looser elements of that coming through time. So, but the big bird is interesting because that's sort of kind of pulled through, I think, from the medieval past, where ostentatious display, medieval banquets, elite, wealthy dining will not just have a variety of meats, different types of meats, but also a diversity of those meats and diversity of fowl. Mm. And what was very good to make a kind of a splash, I suppose, really, or to say, look at all the money I have, look what I can do, look what my cooks can do in the kitchen, would be to present flamboyance in the form of big birds. And you get the sort of the cliched, the stereotyped flamboyant representatives there, like the swans, the peacocks, the cranes, the herons. And then when Europe goes into the New World, they get another bird. They meet another new bird there, which is the turkey. And of course, that coming back to Europe becomes an item of exoticness, of a different, faraway, exotic world. And that joins the kind of the company of the other birds. But then, I suppose, as kind of food practices were sort of calmed to some extent, the remnants of the big birds that were brought to the table in the more modern period, throughout the 18th, the 19th, and into the 20th centuries, are the two big ones still are the goose and the turkey.
Yeah.
So they do remember a time of great flamboyance and extravagance. And of elite and I suppose wealthy dining, and it's our kind of our attempt to recreate that sense of specialness at a special time in the calendar year.
Yeah, but far from a time of flamboyance, we're at a time of a cost of living crisis now at the moment. And I mentioned Mrs. Beaton earlier on. I know she was very interested in how much things cost, and she costed every dish in her recipe book. Do you think that might come into fashion? How did she work it out?
Yeah, I mean, she's really interesting, even though she gets a lot of bad press and, you know, her recipes might have been her own and all that sort of stuff. But it's very interesting because, like, I just looked specifically at the pudding, okay, and the Christmas pudding. And again, the Christmas pudding that we have is something that was practiced for centuries, but it wasn't specifically tied to Christmas. This is a dish that's seasonal at this time of the year. So because of that, you can have puddings before Christmas and at Christmas, and then after Christmas as well into March, for example.
Oh,
so you can see that they're kind of very busy and interested around the pudding. So she has six recipes for puddings that we might kind of recognise as being Christmas puddings. One of them specifically is called the Christmas plum pudding, and that's fairly rich enough. But what she does is that she costs them in terms of the cooking cost, the ingredient cost, and how many people there are, those costings, I suppose, how many those then will feed. And also, of course, there's a seasonality aspect to the recipes as well, because if the ingredients are in season, they're going to be cheaper, obviously, because they're going to be a bit in glut and so on. So it's kind of a very well worked out system whereby she's looking at the cooking time, she's making a costing for that. She's looking at the season in terms of availability, how many they're going to feed. And then she works out an average cost, of course, based on the purchase of the ingredients as well. And how you can sort of, I suppose, slip around the cost in that instance, that, for example, you might want to have a Christmas pudding or a pudding for Christmas, but you might have a lot of money. So you can add in there kind of bulking out ingredients like mashed potatoes and mashed carrots in your pudding that might replace some of the eggs or the other expensive
really?
Things. Or she has things like, you know, for the really good pudding, you could buy the best grade of sugar, because sugar is graded depending on how it's processed and all that sort of stuff. So in the really expensive ones, it's the highest priced sugar, whereas in the others, it might be substituted by a lower grade or treacle, for example.
Yeah, well, so mashed potato in your Christmas pudding is quite a reach. God almighty, things would want to be bad. But I suppose that's what you're looking for when you go to Mrs. Beaton, all the tips. Regina, thank you so much for joining us to talk us through the foods of Christmas past. That's Regina Sexton, who is a food and culinary historian.